This is Ann Weller with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. During the next 30 minutes, I will be sharing nutrition information with you. This information is selected from the Nutrition Action Health Letter, a publication of the Center for Science in the Public Interest, based in Washington, D.C. The Center for Science in the Public Interest was founded in 1971 by three scientists who wanted to apply their academic training to the solving of social problems. The center's staff conduct innovative research and other programs in health and nutrition, and provide consumers with current information about their health and well-being. An independent, nonprofit consumer health group, the center promotes honest food labeling and advertising, safer and more nutritious foods, and pro-health alcohol policies. The work of the Center for Science in the Public Interest is supported by Nutrition Action Health Letter subscribers and foundation grants. It accepts no government or industry funding, and Nutrition Action Health Letter, which was first published in 1974, accepts no advertising. The following edition of Nutrition News is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Please use the information presented in this broadcast in consultation with your personal physician. A small piece of fried chicken, a few fries, and about 1 cup of cola have 500 calories. So do a bowl of mixed melons, chicken, and seasonal tomatoes, rice pilaf, baby arugula salad, and 2 cups of unsweetened iced tea. Which of these dinners is likely to leave you feeling less hungry? Well, studies show that day after day, people eat about the same weight or volume of food. So, if you choose foods with fewer calories per pound or per bite, you will feel just as full on fewer calories. And that's the idea behind the Ultimate Volumetrics Diet, a new book by Pennsylvania State University's Barbara Rolls. In the cover story of the March 2012 issue of Nutrition Action Health Letter, Director of Nutrition Bonnie Liebman explores how we can trim our weight by trimming the calories per bite of food. This report, entitled Don't Be Dense, Trim Calories Per Bite to Trim Pounds, is the presentation of the results of Ms. Liebman's interview of Dr. Barbara Rolls, professor and Helen A. Guthrie Chair of Nutritional Sciences at Penn State University. Dr. Rolls is also a past president of the Obesity Society and the Society for the Study of Ingestive Behavior. Dr. Rolls began studying calorie density when, in the 1990s, she was looking at the effects of fat, carbohydrate, and protein on hunger, the quality of feeling satiated or full, and food intake. She kept noticing that people were eating a consistent amount of food. Rather than regulating their calories, it looked like they were managing the weight of their food. They ate the same weight and the same volume. But since it's harder to get a reliable measure of volume, they would weigh what we gave them before and after a meal. And they found that as long as the food was equally palatable, people tended to eat the same weight of food. So Dr. Roll says, then we thought if we lower the calorie density, the calories per bite or per any given portion of food, perhaps we can lower the overall calorie intake of the meal. It took us about a year to figure out how to lower calorie density, without changing the palatability of the recipes. The high and low calorie foods have to taste equally good. So once we got that down, we saw that we could lower the calorie density by about one third. And sure enough, people over a couple of days ate about the same amount of food. They were spontaneously reducing their calorie intake by about 25%. And that was really exciting. It was a new way of thinking about food. Dr. Roll says that the key to cutting calories per bite is to change the amount of water in foods, because water adds weight and volume, but no calories. So, for example, if you increase the amount of water in a casserole, which we do primarily by adding vegetables, which are mostly water, you lower the calorie density. And the people in these studies were not trying to lose weight. However, in our one-year trial, lowering calorie density did lead to weight loss. We told one group to eat smaller portions and low-fat foods. That lowered calorie density. The people in that study lost 15 pounds in the first 6 months. The other group got similar information about fat, but were told to eat more fruits and vegetables, soups, and other foods with low calorie density. And the people in that group lost 20 pounds in the first 6 months. At the end of the year, both groups had kept most of the weight off. They regained only 1.5 pounds. Now we're gradually building up a consistent story. For example, when we pulled all the data on 700-plus people in the Premier trial, we found that calorie density was the main predictor of how much weight people lost. If people were eating a diet that was less calorie dense, they were eating significantly more food, about a pound more food per day, and they were eating fewer calories and losing more weight. That was consistent with a recent study that looked at weight loss maintainers, that is, people who have lost at least 10% of their maximum body weight and maintained that loss for at least 5 years. The maintainers ate foods with lower calorie density than people who were either overweight or of normal weight. The average maintainer ate 5 servings of vegetables a day, while the normal weight participants ate 4 a day, and the overweight participants ate 3.5 servings of vegetables a day. And portion size matters. In other studies, we served people ordinary portions for 11 days, or increased the portion sizes by 50% for another 11 days. With larger portions, we saw a huge increase in how much people ate, about 400 calories more a day. I was stunned. I thought people would slow down when they realized that they were eating more, but they just do not notice. Big portions make people feel more full. Most of the literature indicates that within 3 or 4 days, your body should detect a perturbation in calorie balance. Our first study lasted 2 days, and people said it didn't go long enough, so we tried 11 days. People do not see the 2 serving sizes side by side. There's usually a week between tests. But in our macaroni and cheese study, we doubled the portions. That's a huge difference. Yet people were unaware. And in our lab, people are eating alone in a booth. They have nothing to think about except the food in front of them. and they are still not noticing that we are varying the portion size. However, people are usually more distracted than that when they eat. If you think about people eating out, not paying attention, having some wine, talking, it is even less likely that they are going to notice portion size. We all hear that portion sizes have gotten bigger, but people just don't pay attention. If the food is in front of them, they tend to eat it. It's a really robust effect, and it affects everybody, whether they are plate cleaners or dieters, restrained or unrestrained eaters. Ms. Liebman questioned Dr. Rolls, asking if people eat the same amount of food day after day, why would big portions make them eat more? Dr. Rolls replies that we tend to eat the same weight or volume of food, but when we are exposed to large portions, they can override this tendency and ramp up our intake. The good news is that if big portions are low in calorie density, they do not lead to weight gain like big portions that are calorie dense. Portion size does not affect how much we eat more than calorie density. Most people think of portion size first, but when we tested them head to head, calorie density had a greater effect. We used foods that are commercially available, like pizza, blueberry muffins, brownies, potato chips, cheese and crackers, and turkey sandwiches. We either decreased the calorie density by 25% and kept the portion size the same, or we decreased the portion size by 25% and kept the calorie density the same. Then we decreased both by 25%. Each condition lasted 2 days. Interestingly, if people noticed any difference, they were more likely to notice a decrease in portion size. They only noticed a difference in calorie density with some baked goods, where we substituted applesauce for some of the fat. But even there, the ratings of palatability were similar, and these were big changes. The 25% reduction in calorie density led to a 24% decrease in calorie intake over 2 days, while the 25% decrease in portion size led only to a 10% reduction in calorie intake. When we cut both calorie density and portion size, we got more than a 32% decrease in daily calorie intake. So both effects are huge, robust, persistent, and independent. Dr. Rolls says that, "I think the food industry could tweak a little of this and a little of that, so consumers would still be happy. They could help people save calories without noticing or with little effort and no sacrifice. To me, it's a no-brainer. If we can do 25% reduction in portion size or in calorie density, why can't they do a little bit?" So just cutting portions is not enough. Everybody blames portion size for the obesity epidemic. It's not big portions that are leading to obesity. It's big portions of calorie-dense foods. If we ate bigger portions of low-calorie-dense foods, that would help us eat less. Now, beverages have a low-calorie density, but you have to look at food and beverages separately. It's the calorie density of food, not beverages, that's best associated with body weight. If someone is drinking a lot of a diet soda along with a triple cheeseburger and fries, their calorie density looks really low because the soda has such a huge effect on the calculations. Even if the calorie density of the food is high. Beverages are different because hunger and thirst are not the same. People describe thirst as a dry, unpleasant sense in the mouth. They describe hunger as stomach rumbling, sometimes headachy, or a lethargic mood. And hunger and thirst are regulated by different mechanisms. If you get too little liquid, it's going to shrink your cells. And osmoreceptors in your brain and other parts of your body are going to sense that cells need water. So that makes you thirsty. So does a decrease in your blood volume, which is sensed by receptors around your heart and kidneys. In contrast, food intake is regulated by a completely different set of receptors and mechanisms, including gut hormones, blood glucose, and insulin. And soups are not like other liquids. Some liquids seem to perform like foods. Soup is a very effective liquid food for decreasing hunger. Soda, however, does not affect hunger much. Milk curbs hunger when we use it in thicker beverages, like shakes and smoothies. When we use them as a first course, they reduce subsequent food intake. But when we use plain skim milk, it did not curb hunger any more than soda. Other researchers, however, have found that milk does reduce hunger. Some scientists think that viscosity has an impact on hunger. But we need more data. We did look at temperature. We gave people V8 as either a hot or cold soup because it is palatable either way. And we found that temperature had no effect on subsequent food intake. The V8 juice reduced intake, even though it is a thin liquid. Ms. Lehman then asked Dr. Rolls if she advises people to switch to diet drinks. Dr. Rolls replies, "I like to leave that up to them. If they are uncomfortable with the idea of a sugar substitute, they shouldn't go there. However, we have never found that diet lemonade or sodas cause hunger, as some animal studies suggest. But your best beverage is water. But if people can substitute a lower calorie or calorie-free beverage for one with calories and not use it as a reason to eat more food, that's fine. So cutting liquid calories is key. It is one of the easiest ways to cut calories. People are taking in so many calories from soda and even fruit drinks, and you have hundreds of lower calorie choices. So why not do that as a first choice? You can calculate the calorie density of any food by dividing its calories by its weight in grams, and you'll find both on most food labels. People can cut calorie density by reducing fat and by adding vegetables and fruit whenever they can. So a pizza would have a bit less cheese and more vegetables. Having a low-calorie dense soup or salad, or even whole pieces of apple at the start of a meal, helps to fill you up so that you eat less at the next course. And you end up eating fewer calories at that meal. Dr. Roll says, "I think of it as a win-win situation because you are getting more food, more nutrient-rich food, and you are less hungry, and you are managing your weight. Now, not all low-fat foods have a low calorie density. Low-fat cookies and brownies, baked potato chips, and pretzels are low in fat, but they are not low in calorie density. And low fat on the label might give people license to eat more. We found that people ate more yogurt if it was labeled low fat. They responded more to the label than to the actual calorie content. Marketers have a huge impact on how much we eat and on how full we feel. You can also reduce sugar or refined grains that you do not need. And best of all, you can add foods that we need to eat more often. Vegetables are critical players, but you can also add fruits, whole grains, and seafood. We add huge amounts of vegetables to mixed dishes, pasta, stews, and soups. We cook whole vegetables and put them in a blender. It is so easy. We can reduce the calorie density by 15, 20, or even 25%. In studies we published last year, we changed calorie density by adding vegetables to breakfast, lunch, and dinner for both kids and adults. The main problem was that the vegetable-enhanced baked goods were more palatable. For example, a carrot bread with extra carrots tasted better because it was so moist, so people ate more, but they still got fewer calories over the whole day. Miss Liebman asked Dr. Rolls, "How much vegetable do you add?" And Dr. Rolls responds that you can start with about a quarter cup for each serving. For example, if a meatloaf or pasta serves four people, add about one cup of vegetables instead of meat or pasta. With mixed dishes, it's also easy. Take macaroni and cheese, for example. If you use a light-colored vegetable like summer squash, cauliflower, onion, or parsnips, you can put in lots. And you can sneak purees and chopped broccoli or spinach into dishes with tomato sauce, where they can be hidden by the strong flavor and bold color of the sauce. You have to match the vegetables with the dish to get the palatability right. Mexican or other spicy dishes are particularly good for hiding purees because they have strong flavors. Ms. Liebman asks Dr. Rolls, "Do the vegetables have to be fresh?" And she responds that you can use frozen vegetables. They're fine nutritionally. The texture is not as good as fresh if you eat them as is, but if you're going to puree them, they are fine. I'd like to see companies selling frozen blocks of pureed vegetables with recipes on how to add them to food. And some vegetables already come pureed. Tomato and pumpkin come in cans. Summer squash comes pureed and frozen. There should be more. But remember, you're not just adding vegetables. Taking away meat or pasta. You have to substitute vegetables for other items, like beef or rice. You cannot add just any vegetables. A lot of vegetables that people add may be calorie dense. And if the vegetables are slathered with cream sauce or with oil dripping off, like they often are at restaurants, that's not going to help. What I like about cutting calorie density is the flexibility. You don't have to give up food. You don't have to give up any food. You can eat what you like. You just need to eat some things in more moderation than others. And you need to manage portions of foods with higher calorie density. Now, here are a few examples of how you might cut the calorie density of some foods that you like. For example, spinach salad. You might cut the calorie density of that by making it with a lower fat dressing and without bacon, and by adding more vegetables. Or the traditional fettuccine or Alfredo, you might cut calorie density of that by switching from a cream sauce to a small amount of olive oil, and by adding vegetables, and by using whole wheat pasta and a decreased portion of pasta. We've reached the conclusion of this month's segment of Nutrition News, and the show will be rebroadcast this week on Friday at 11 p.m. and on Saturday at 3 p.m. Please join me for the next edition of Nutrition News, which will air on Wednesday, June 6, 2012. I'm Ann Weller, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And I hope that you've enjoyed the show. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience, and it is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next month.